ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning, welcome to AM. It's Friday, the 7th of November. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Serious and organised crime groups are tightening their grip on Australia's illicit tobacco market, with the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission linking the trade to firebombings and violent attacks. And new figures show the trade is costing Australia billions of dollars every year. Samantha Dick reports.
Australia is the most expensive country in the world to be a smoker, with an average packet of cigarettes now costing around $40. But there's also a gap in the market for illicit or illegal tobacco. In a public address last night, the chief executive of the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission, Heather Cook, says organised criminals are exploiting it.
Since 2023, efforts by organised crime groups to control the illicit tobacco and vape market have led to over 200 firebombings, at least 3 homicides, including an innocent civilian.
New figures from the Commission and the Australian Institute of Criminology show serious and organised crime is a growing threat to the nation, costing the economy more than $82 billion in the 2023-24 financial year. The agencies warn crime is becoming increasingly violent and public, drugs are getting deadlier, and more children and teenagers are being recruited to do the bidding of adults in Australia's underbelly.
Many of these criminal syndicates deal in a variety of illicit commodities, from drugs to tobacco to firearms to human trafficking, allowing them to shift their supply to meet a variety of demands, no matter the human cost.
The new crime figures show the associated healthcare costs, reduced productivity and lost tax revenue from Australia's illicit tobacco trade cost $4 billion in the year 2023-24, a fourfold increase over the past 3 years. The CEO of the Australian Association of Convenience Stores, Theo Fakari, says the illicit trade is gutting service stations and corner stores.
As recently as 4 years ago, legal tobacco used to contribute about 40% of our total in-store sales, excluding fuel. That number is down to approximately 15%.
Mr. Fakari says the tipping point happened in 2019, when the government's excise jumped 55% over 3 years.
The crime groups are in like a smuggler's paradise. Okay, so we have the highest excise in the world. We, up until very recently, have had very limited enforcement with meaningless fines and effectively next to no prosecutions.
Australia's illegal tobacco market is leaving a growing hole in the federal budget. The government's tobacco excise revenue, the amount it makes from the tax on cigarettes, has fallen dramatically in recent years, from more than $16 billion in 2020 to just $7.4 billion in 2025. Last month, the government set up a national task force led by the Australian Border Force to crack down on criminals operating in the illicit trade. Mr. Fakari says the first thing the government should do is wind back its taxes on tobacco, making legal cigarettes more affordable.
The excise needs to be reduced by about half, down to the 2018-2019 level, which would see a legal packet available for $25. Compared to an illegal packet, which is on average around $15.
Alongside an intense education campaign, the increased cost of cigarettes has helped significantly reduce smoking rates in Australia since the early 1990s.
Samantha Dick reporting. Australia's fledgling submarine agency is bracing for a shake-up, with the admiral in charge of the massive AUKUS program stepping down after 5 years in the job. Vice Admiral Jonathan Mead, the first boss of the Australian Submarine Agency, has announced he'll retire next year. That'll be just 12 months before US nuclear-powered submarines are due to start rotating through Perth, the first tangible element of the massive AUKUS agreement. National Affairs correspondent Jane Norman reports.
Vice Admiral Jonathan Mead can remember the day he was summoned to the Defence Chief's office and given a top-secret mission to develop options for Australia to acquire a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines. It was February 2021. It'd be another 7 months before the world would first hear the acronym AUKUS.
I thought I'd seen a lot in 37 years, but the enormity of that task was breathtaking. I knew how monumental this step would be for Australia, a generational leaping capability.
The tiny task force he started has rapidly grown to become the much bigger Australian Submarine Agency, responsible for running the $368 billion project. Soon, there'll be a changing of the guard. Vice Admiral Meade announcing he'll step down next year after 5 years at the helm.
The US has total support and believes that Australia is on the right pathway. We've met all the milestones for the optimal pathway. Is ready for 27.
2027 is a crucial year for AUKUS. It's when the first US nuclear-powered submarines will start a permanent rotation through HMAS Stirling near Perth. While preparations are underway, some uncertainties linger, including the status of the Pentagon's review and recent revelations that the US might help South Korea build a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines. Asked about the implications for Australia, Defence Minister Richard Miles appeared relaxed.
I have absolute confidence that in terms of the arrangements that we have with the United States, and for that matter with the United Kingdom, they will all go unchanged by the announcement that's been made between the US and Korea.
Officials are watching the deal closely because Australia plans to start acquiring nuclear-powered submarines from America in the early 2030s before building its own fleet. As the project scales up, another unanswered question is where those subs will dock on Australia's east coast. Richard Miles delaying any decision on that until after the next election.
But I think it's important that our submarines in the fullness of time are able to operate from both sides of our continent.
Defence experts have expressed scepticism that AUKUS will deliver the promised nuclear-powered submarines on time and have criticised the government for refusing to consider a Plan B. Vice Admiral Meade rebuffed those critics.
This is an absolute high priority. It's a no-fail mission for us. The region around us is changing, and in order to meet that change, we need to have a defence force that is capable to defend itself and, if need be, project itself.
Vice Admiral Jonathan Meade ending that report by Jane Norman. Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, the man formerly known as Prince Andrew, has been ordered to appear before Congress in Washington for questioning over his links to the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The ABC's Europe Bureau Chief, Mazoe Ford, joined me earlier. Mazoe, a US congressional panel investigating Epstein has written to Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor. What does the letter say?
Well, he's been sent a letter by Democratic members of the House Committee on Oversight, and in it, they request he submit to questioning as part of their investigation into Jeffrey Epstein's criminal operations. The statement they've put out today says the committee would investigate allegations of abuse by Mountbatten-Windsor and will seek information on Epstein's operations network and associates based on the man's long-standing and well-documented friendship. And it adds that rich and powerful men have evaded justice for too long. Now the former Prince Andrew has the opportunity to come clean and provide justice for survivors. So a strong statement there. Mountbatten-Windsor's name appears in documents and flight logs which were subpoenaed from Epstein's estate, and they were publicly released by the committee. So they're wanting to question him about those as well. The former prince, of course, has always denied any wrongdoing. So the big question though, Rachel, is would he actually turn up? Well, the US Congress has sweeping powers to subpoena people it wants to question. However, they don't apply to foreign nationals, meaning that Mr. Mountbatten-Windsor cannot be compelled to testify. So he has until November the 20th to respond as to what he wants to do.
And King Charles had, of course, already announced that he was stripping his brother Andrew of his titles, but now that's been made official.
Yes, there's a new entry into Britain's official public record, The Gazette, and it shows the removal of Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor's royal style and titles has now come into effect. And the entry reads, "The King has been pleased by letters patent under the Great Seal of the Realm to declare that Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor shall no longer be entitled to hold and enjoy the style, title or attribute of Royal Highness and the titular dignity of Prince." So some very royal language there, but essentially saying that he's no longer part of this monarchy, that this act of stripping him of these royal titles is now done. Of course, last month, Andrew said that he would give up his titles and honours, but the pressure on the palace continued, especially with the release of that posthumous memoir by Virginia Giuffre, who accused Andrew of having sex with her when she was 17 years old. And then there were those revelations about the Royal Lodge on the Windsor estate and that Andrew had not paid any meaningful rent on that, that 30-bedroom mansion there on the sprawling grounds. He's going to be moving out of that in the coming weeks. Now, the royal family didn't announce this entry of the formal stripping of the titles in the Gazette. It was just published quietly and media has found it. What the royals are trying to do is just get on with the job, basically. We've seen Prince William this week in Brazil for COP30 and the Earthshot Prize. Princess Anne is heading your way. She leaves on Saturday for a trip to Singapore and Australia. So they're trying to get on with things. But of course, every day seems to bring another headline about Andrew.
Mazoe Ford in London. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians are still blocked from returning home as Israeli forces continue to hold the so-called Yellow Line in Gaza, occupying more than half of the strip under the fragile ceasefire. With vague commitments about rebuilding and further withdrawals of Israeli troops, some across the war-ravaged strip fear there'll be two Gazas created, and neither will be suitable for Palestinians to live in. Here's Middle East correspondent Matthew Dorn.
In central Gaza, around Deir al-Balah, rows and rows of bright blue and stark white tents cut through the grey and brown dusty haze. Amidst the rubble, many Palestinians are living in these makeshift communities. Among them is Kamal el-Sheikh, originally from Shejaiya on the eastern edge of Gaza City. He hasn't been home for much of the war.
I did not try and go there, but my brothers went and could not reach the site. It's forbidden. It's beyond the yellow line.
That's the name given to the boundary of the Israeli-controlled area in Gaza, taking in large parts of what were once bustling cities. It's the line where Israeli forces withdrew to as part of the first phase of the US-brokered ceasefire to allow hostages to be freed. Few who crossed the line live to tell the tale, although Nasser al-Najjar did briefly make it to the far north of the strip, near Jabalia.
The other day I just went to look at my home. The army was above me and they began shooting at us. I was there for a couple of minutes and then I left.
Israeli forces have committed to opening fire on anyone who dares approach or cross the line, who they deem to be a threat to the safety of their troops. Palestinian authorities say civilians are among the dead. In one incident, almost a dozen members of the same family travelling in a bus were killed a fortnight ago, among them women and children. The suggestion from the US and even the Israeli military is that the area inside the Yellow Line will be the first to be redeveloped and rebuilt, and Israeli troops will gradually withdraw further as Hamas lays down its weapons. But Wissam Afife, who has run Hamas-controlled media outlets, says that's a pipe dream and a cover for ongoing Israeli occupation.
No doubt this is an attempt to create two Gazas, one under the authority of Israeli security and the other Gaza as a refugee zone to the so-called terrorists or those living in the areas that are under control of Hamas.
The war was not ended. It's a ceasefire in order to prepare ourselves to the next phase.
Avi Dichter is a minister in Benjamin Netanyahu's security cabinet and a former director of the intelligence agency Shin Bet.
Do you believe that that rebuilding will actually occur? And is there a risk that effectively there would be two Gazas, almost one that is redeveloped and one that is left to decay?
I can't believe that Gaza will be rebuilt the way that the Western countries and the Arab countries who are relevant for it think it should be, as long as Gaza Strip is dominated by Hamas directly or indirectly.
While the need to rebuild Gaza is clear, the destruction is immense and there are obvious fears for the fragile truce surviving. Israel and Hamas have accused each other of repeatedly violating it in the months since it came into force. Comments like these from senior members of the Netanyahu government, such as Avi Dichter, also don't instill much confidence.
I know some Israeli leaders that believed that Gaza will become Singapore of the Middle East. I told them, I don't know about Singa. Poor it's going to be.
This is Matthew Doran in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
Nancy Pelosi, who's served in the US Congress for nearly 40 years and is one of the Democrats' most effective politicians, is retiring. The San Francisco Congresswoman and former Speaker of the House announced she'll not seek re-election next year. Emily Grimmins is in Washington. She joined me earlier.
At the end of her term in early 2027, Ms. Pelosi will have served 40 years in Congress. And of course, 20 of them, she was the leader of the Democrats in the House. And even more historically significant, she was the first ever, and to this date, the only female Speaker of the House. That's a very powerful role in US politics. She served two terms as Speaker and only stepped down from the House Democrat leadership 3 years ago. Now, she's been very important to the Democrats because she has been a very effective operator in Congress. She was a key opponent of the Republican presidents George Bush and Donald Trump in his first term as well. In fact, she's one of Mr. Trump's favourite targets because she is a real agitator in politics here. She's also a massive fundraiser for the Democrats and an influential sort of elder statesman figure. When she was seen last year to be cooling in her support of Joe Biden's presidential run, that was really seen as a bit of a death knell for his campaign for re-election. So she has been just a giant of Democratic politics here in America. She represents a deep blue seat in San Francisco, and in announcing her retirement today, she said she's looking forward to serving out her final year in Congress and representing her constituents in San Francisco.
Emily Grimmins in Washington. The Winter Olympics are now only months away, and Australia has some medal contenders getting ready to pack their bags for Milano Cortina in Italy. But it's an expensive pursuit, and for some of the less well-known athletes, it's a huge financial struggle just to make it to the Games. Amanda Shalala reports.
That's a DJ mix from Lara Hamilton. She's also a trained opera singer, a digital marketer, a world-class trail runner, and now hoping to qualify for ski mountaineering's Olympic debut.
In excess of like 17 to 20 hours a week, trying to train for two sports, and that it does take over your life. I also have a few part-time jobs because that's just the reality of it.
Hamilton's currently based in France and relies on crowdfunding and donations from her community back in Sydney to fund travel and equipment.
I don't own more than three pairs of skis, and all of them are currently bashed up, so I'm still trying to figure out how to afford a pair of skis, which sounds so silly because I'm like preparing for the Olympics and it's a struggle.
Sammy Gall is coming back from an ACL reconstruction. The 24-year-old Canberra-based alpine skier is also aiming to make her first Games.
It is completely self-funded. We're not on a salary or anything, so it's a big effort getting sponsorship. I work a few different jobs. I don't even have a car when I'm in Australia because that's a big expense. Really, I'm like fully going after this dream.
The Australian Sport Foundation's Running on Empty report found nearly half of elite athletes live below the poverty line, earning less than $23,000 per year. Hamilton and Gall are both currently fundraising through the ASF, but Western Sydney University's Dr. Michelle O'Shea says it's a flawed system.
It's a little bit of a cruel optimism, if you will, insofar as the athletes that are likely to garner, you know, the most number of donations are those that already have the greatest profile. And problematically, what it also does is it pits athletes against one another.
She says it can be harder for female athletes who have historically had less investment and exposure than men, and para-athletes who have added expenses like equipment modifications, something three-time Winter Paralympian Ben Tudhope knows well.
Bronze to Ben Tudhope!
Paralympic athletes still are not equal in the funding levels to their Olympic counterparts. And so they still have a financial hardship even when they do reach the top level.
Dr. O'Shea says the government must investigate alternatives.
Insufficient government support for Australian para and Olympic athletes represents a risk, particularly as we look towards 2032 and home Brisbane-based Games.
And Sammy Gall relates to that.
It's just really tough for where I'm at to continue my sport when funding it is such a huge undertaking. That's really tough mentally as well.
Alpine skier Sammy Gall, ending that report by Amanda Shalala. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. When do you know you've made it? Well, the head of the chip-making giant NVIDIA must have a fair idea. The company's value topped $5 trillion last week. He's not alone. Two other tech giants have also hit the $4 trillion mark. So when's the bust coming? Today, the ABC's chief business correspondent, Ian Verinder. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.